The substance of the lecture for today can be best introduced, I think, by some description of the genesis of it. It comes out rather this way, that each year we welcome into the classes at the University of Chicago a new group of students, and it's difficult to know how to start their experience within university studies. Because these students come on the whole from very different kinds of homes and local communities, the nature and the quality of their education before they get here is very different. They represent very wide ranges in social and intellectual sophistication, and they nevertheless must somehow be forged into a group of students who confront together certain issues which a university exists in order to propose and to inquire into. And therefore, the matter of teaching students, particularly this modern generation of students, is vastly complicated by the variety of our American experience, the variety of situations from which students come, and the variety of expectations they bring to university students. Now, within the Divinity School of the University of Chicago, this problem is particularly complicated because to the varieties that I have already said something about, there is added another one, a vast variety in religious experience and church or non-church backgrounds. And therefore, we have puzzled ourselves for some years as to how we might introduce students into religious and theological studies in such a way that we might find what might be called a common starting place, which all together would recognize as being reasonable and would be both big enough to introduce the kind of concerns we were interested in and also close enough to each student's experience that he would feel himself actually addressed by what we were saying. And therefore, after the expenditure of a great deal of faculty sweat on the point, we came up with an experimental course which has been taught but once and which will be repeated this year, and we have called the course the American Experience. Now, we do not presume, of course, that those of us who are teaching the course know for sure what the American Experience is. The accent is not upon the article the, as if there was a common and clearly perceptible American experience, or one or several kinds of experiences which together constitute the American man. We were saying something much more modest. We were simply saying that what we have in common is that we are all Americans, that we have all, to some degree of depth or other, experienced not only the present events in our American life, but also stand at the end of a long inheritance of American history. We have our episodes, our accumulated folk legends, our Thanksgiving and pilgrims into the wilderness and all that kind of business which we bring together to what it means to be an American person. And we thought that reflection upon that would be a good starting point. Now, another element entered into our reflection. We have supposed that such an inquiry into what constitutes the American experience is a necessary starting point, particularly for this troubled generation of students, because all over the place people are talking about what's wrong with American life, and the phrases, the erosion of values, the breakdown of law and order, the disintegration of older virtues supposed to have been in the possession of our forefathers, this kind of language and this eloquence of lamentation is very widely heard. And therefore, we wanted to inquire afresh into our common life in North America here and ask if it's possible to see what constitutes the American man in his American particularity. Every European knows, as he looks at America, And every American who goes to Europe is made quickly aware of the fact that he is different, and that this different is not separable from the fact that he has grown up in this place rather than another place. And in order to carry off this course, we saw very quickly that no one person could do it. And therefore, we invented what is called here and other places a staff course. The three of us who teach the course have isolated what we believe to be common issues in American life, and then we have treated each of these issues from three perspectives. On one day of the week, the historian descriptively and recollectively presents the emergence of an issue, the various ways in which it has found institutional expression, has engendered intellectual reflection, and lays this out before the class. Then, on a second day, a literary critic deals with the same theme, but not this time historically, but rather looking for and digging out those instances in American literature in which trouble about this theme or reflection about it has actually found a place in our common literature. And then, on the last of the 3 days of the week, on which the course meets, the theologian, having sat through and listened and studied with the students the historical evidence and read the literary evidence, now reflects upon what this evidence and these events might mean for American religious life or for American reflection in general. Now, one of the themes that we elaborated very quickly, and we shall do again this year, we have called the non-eschatological character of American life. By that we mean, well, what the word eschatological means, and that may need some explication. The eschatological is a term that points to a sense of boundedness, of finitude, that not all things are possible, that man's life is fundamentally finite, that he moves despite all the energy and the resolution and the enthusiasm of his days. He moves from life toward the final moment when he shall not live at all but be dead. That the fact of boundedness, finitude, limit seems to be built into the human enterprise itself. Now, that would seem to be a fact of life which would be evident to everybody. But as a matter of fact, it is a fact of life which has not received very close attention in American reflection or American literature. The fact that this is so can be illustrated by recalling that the event of death, the inevitability of death, the experience of having to live within given boundaries, is not a very important item in American reflection. If one would look over the sermons that have been preached in the American churches for the past 50 years, he would find that it is very infrequent that death is a subject for preaching. And it's not a subject for preaching because it is not a matter of common interest. Everyone who comes to these shores from outside is impressed by what one book recently has called the American way of death. Our funeral customs are a kind of symbolization of the fact that we do not confront boundedness, finitude, death. We rather evade it. We do not only evade it intellectually, we evade it in the mores with which we attend death. We cosmetize the dead, and we narcotize the survivors. American experience has somehow never introduced the fact of the bounded, the limitation, into the very center of our reflection. And therefore, one of the themes that we wanted to discuss early in the course was what we have called the non-eschatological character of our American reflective and literary and actual life. We have done this, then, by the following method. We have looked back at our American experience as characterized in a land which has, as the historians have noted, than almost illimitable in the availability of space for the American experience, and have asked whether or not there is a relationship between the spaciousness of the place of the American enterprise and the outcome that American people recognize very reluctantly, that not all things can be accomplished by motion or by resolution or by the expenditure of sheer energy, that there are some issues that have got to be dealt with a different cast of mind. And that constitutes the kind of question to which the present lecture was created as a first effort to illuminate the problem. Now the lecture this morning is one that was directed to an inquiry as to why that is so. Has there been, and can we find out and specify in our American experience, elements, factors, events, ways of thinking, which have constituted the fact that we do not easily confront the matter of limitation and of boundary? I begin, therefore, with a kind of historical account, which I'm going to call Space, Time, and American History, and make an effort to ask how these two magnitudes of space and time have actually operated in our American experience, to ask which has been the stronger and the more formative of the American mind and character. And I begin with an historical recollection. Very early in the 20th century, a prominent American historian, Frederick Jackson Turner, published an essay which had in fact been his presidential address to the American Historical Society, and he called his address The Frontier in American History. The point of his address was this. He said that all previous ways of interpreting American history had to be called into question, because the perspectives of the early efforts of American historians to understand American life had all understood American life in terms of it being a kind of extension of European life. That is, the American states huddled together on the eastern seaboard had been understood primarily as colonial settlements. These were European people no longer in Europe, but when they came here, they re-established in these states European political models, European social life, European personal style. They even imported, as you know, American or European silver and European furniture. They lived their lives here as transplanted European people. The point of Frederick Jackson Turner's inquiry was to call into question the legitimacy of this way of writing American history. He insisted that American politics, for instance, was not simply an extension of European politics, that American political forms had grown with a certain immediate naturalness out of American situations, that our American social life was formed by the American situation and was not simply a transplantation of European social understanding, that American individual ways of thinking and feeling and beholding and tasting the world, as he put it, were not simply European transplants, but there was something intrinsic, something quite specifically American about all of these things. Now, of course, after Turner's lecture was widely known and criticized among the historians, a certain amount of flack began to appear, and certain criticisms were made. Before I insist, as I shall in a moment, that Turner's vision was centrally correct, we ought to acknowledge these criticisms. First of all, the criticism was made that Turner did not take into account sufficiently the vast variety of the persons who came to North America in the 17th and 18th centuries, that whereas Mr. Turner had concentrated upon the New England experience, there were many other ports of entry through which people who became American had actually come to this place. There was the South, through the port of New Orleans, the great Southwest. It was not only New England Puritans, but European Catholics and other people, and particularly the Jewish community, who came to this place, and that any effort to generalize so singly and so simply as Turner had undertaken was historically an error. Now I think the force of these criticisms must be acknowledged, and later work on Turner's thesis has in fact acknowledged them and has corrected his thesis at those points. But I shall continue on the assumption that the main thrust of Turner's address was and remains a very profound truth, that the frontier, always there, always out in front, a vast space always available to the American man, has been a very formative influence in the unfolding of the pageantry of American life. Now, in order that this point should be made clear, I want to begin by discussing the frontier under the phrase, the frontier as the illimitable. The meaning of this designation is, of course, one aspect of the frontier, but the power of it can be made clear by contrast. Who were these people who came to this place? Immigrants, all of them. And where did they come from? Virtually without exception. That exception, of course, is a very large one, and nothing I say will really apply to the black community. But virtually without exception, these people came from the established settlements that were already in Europe and had there been established for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. For centuries, before the white man established his settlements in New England, at the mouth of the Hudson, in the Virginia Tidewater, and in the Carolinas, the living space of European peoples had been divided among many nations. Now the borders of the space in which these people lived in Europe were, to be sure, fixed. They were fixed by the North Sea and the Baltic, by the Mediterranean on the south, by the Atlantic Ocean to the west, and by the Urals and other mountains to the east. It was within this fixed space, what one might call a given space, that for hundreds of years European life and culture had been developed. We have in the literature of Europe the awareness of the givenness of this space, the kind of closedness of the life situation of these people. We have in their literature, to be sure, the influences of this sense of being closed in. One has only to read about the journals of Marco Polo or Hakluyt's voyages to know how the knowledge of something that was out there beyond this space actually constituted a kind of shimmering fascination for centuries of European life. But at the same time, they knew there was something more out there. They had not penetrated it. It was penetrated, in fact, very seldom, but the interest that marked that penetration only underlies my point that the European peoples for hundreds of years have lived within closed spaces. And as regards the bearing of this fact upon the European mind and the European spirit, that will be addressed in a moment. Now, the situation in North America, when our forefathers came to this place, was completely and profoundly different. These little communities that hugged the eastern shore lived their life, did their work, were very subtly shaped in their thinking by the fact that they knew that what was settled was not identical with what was available. Arching pervasively over the established situation was the knowledge that what they called the West stretched out beyond like an illimitable ocean. One has only to read the sermons of the early New England preachers to notice how often and how eloquently this huge land, which to be sure was unknown in detail, but was known to be there, exercised over the mind of these early people an extraordinary fascination. This seeming illimitability of the American land was not, I am declaring, an isolated factor in the early American consciousness. It was rather the pervasive form of that consciousness. In order to make that point, one has only to turn to American literature, perhaps the most eloquent confessional of our national self-consciousness. And when he does that, he finds there a literature which is permeated through and through with the vastness of the setting of the American enterprise. The journals of the Mathers, the Cottons, the Endicotts, the Winthrops in New England, the travel diaries of de Crevecoeur, the novels of James Fenimore Cooper and Herman Melville, the essays and the public addresses of Ralph Waldo Emerson, all of these breathe an air which blows in from the open frontier. I would suggest, too, that the very form of American humor, particularly when it came to its great expression in the 19th century, that the form of that humor is disclosed by analysis to owe its vitality to the same open vastness of the American geographical setting. For that humor is broad rather than witty. It is obvious and ribald rather than delicate and sly. The humor of Mark Twain, for instance, depends for its delight not upon the situations and the ambiguities of the drawing rooms of the cultivated people of the city, but upon the exaggerations, the trickeries, the buffooneries, the fantastic human types so richly produced on the conventionless frontier. One literary critic has called Mark Twain America's artist of the ridiculous. At a more sober and contemplative level, one finds that American efforts to articulate the promise and hope of the young nation's role and place in history are informed by the language-shaping vastness of this illimitable land. I should like now to use several instances to illustrate how the breadth and sweep of the Midland prairies, the terrifying distances, the huge lakes and the mighty rivers have imparted to the American dream a boldness of conception and almost gargantuan excess of rhetoric. About the middle of the 19th century, Herman Melville, who was a New Yorker of Dutch descent, published his greatest novel. In the following passage from Moby Dick, it is not very difficult to feel how the open, illimitable frontier character of the American experience was taken as a clue to a moral interpretation of the American man generally. It is, I think, a tribute to the power of this feeling that we should find it most movingly expressed in Melville, because almost alone among mid-19th century men of letters, Melville was the one who pierced through the general moral optimism of the expansive spirit of the time and disclosed in powerful fictional characters the ambiguities, the boundaries, the limitations, the tensions, and the dark depths of evil and delusion that lived there. It is, I think, eloquent that Melville should have written these sentences. But as I read them now in a moment, you will note here an authentic note that has become part of our American way of speaking, a note which indicates that there is nothing too big to knock over, nothing too firm to penetrate, There is nothing too far to reach. There is nothing too tough to solve. Every American who goes to Europe confronts European people who smile at this exuberant and generous notion among American people that there is nothing we cannot accomplish. Everyone notices this, but I think it has perhaps never been expressed more eloquently than in Melville's passage. He writes, "It is a thing most sorrowful, nay, shocking, to expose the fall of valor in the soul. Men may seem detestable as joint stock companies and nations. Knaves, fools, and murderers they may be. Men may have mean and meager faces, but man in the ideal is so noble, so sparkling, such a grand and glowing creature, that over any ignominious blemish in him, all his fellows should run to throw their costliest robes. That immaculate manliness we feel within ourselves, so far within us that it remains intact, though all the outer character seem gone, this bleeds with keenest anguish at the spectacle of a valor-ruined man. Nor can piety itself, at such a shameful sight, completely stifle her upbraidings against the permitting stars. This dignity I treat of is not the dignity of kings and robes, but that abounding dignity which has no robed investiture. Thou shalt see it shining in the arm that wields a pick or drives a spike, that democratic dignity which on all hands radiates without end from God himself, the great God absolute, the center and circumference of all democracy, his omnipresence, our divine equality." That's the end of the Melville statement. What I should like to point out in that statement is the close identification in it of the expansiveness of God himself, the Creator, the close relationship of that, and the American man's understanding of his democratic institutions. He somehow came to believe that God himself was a Democrat, that God himself was somehow on the side of democratic institutions, and that work, energy, resolution, the whacking away through a wilderness and the establishment of homes in a frontier was somehow peculiarly pleasing to the Almighty. Now, several decades later, another Easterner, Walt Whitman, shattered the reigning form of poetical expression and in a veritable flood of verse wrought out a voice for America's vague but deep and powerful feeling for her own national character and promise. In the poetry of Whitman, place names and common terms for common products of land and mine and forest are strung into melodious sequences that exercise the force of a positive incantation. The result is to produce out of the sheer overwhelming rhythm of names that suggest vast space and scope, richness and distance, the intoxication of the illimitable land. That this illimitable, forward-leaning vitality often foresaw concrete achievements and conquests that are of doubtful moral significance is not immediately to the point. But I choose to make the point from the work of Whitman the following characteristic passage: "Land of coal and iron, land of gold, land of cotton, sugar, rice, land of wheat, beef, pork, land of wool and hemp, land of the apple and the grape, land of the pastoral plains, the grass fields of the world, land of those sweet-aired, interminable plateaus." A second poem from Walt Whitman is instructive, for here the generality of the piece I have just read is given considerable concreteness from an actual anecdotal record of the century that we have since called the winning of the West. And in this poem there is revealed, I think, how the fact of limit, death, that which man for all his resolution cannot overcome, how all of these boundaries and limits are simply burned away in the sheer incandescence of the song of conquest and assertion. I shall read four stanzas from Whitman's poem, Pioneers. Come, my tan-faced children, follow well in order, get your weapons ready. Have you your pistols? Have you your sharp-edged axes, pioneers, O pioneers? Have the elder races halted? Do they droop and end their lesson, wearied over there beyond the seas? We take up the task eternal, and the burden and the lesson, pioneers, O pioneers. All the pulses of the world falling as they beat for us with the Western movement beat, holding single or together, steady moving to the front, all for us, pioneers, O pioneers. They are of us, they are with us, all for primal needed work, while the followers there in embryo wait behind. We are today's procession heading, we the route for travel clearing, pioneers, O pioneers. It is now 32 years since my first extended visit to Europe when I was a student there, and those months way back in 1937 were spent mostly in Germany. At Heidelberg in that year, there were very few American students, and there was not, as there have since been established, departments of American studies in these universities. But there were a few students there who were Americans, and they were rather eagerly invited into close relationships with the German students. At Heidelberg, in the year I was there, there had been established a little group of German students who were interested in American literature. And of course they could all read American books, but they could not read American English with sufficient fluency to realize the rhythm and the sound of it. And therefore, knowing that I had come to study at their university, this group invited me to participate in one of several such informal groups. And when I met with them, they asked me to read aloud for them from certain American novels in which they had passages which they wanted me specifically to read. I think I was never conscious, as I became in that experience, of what it means to have grown up in the illimitable land of North America. What life in open space has meant to us, in contrast with European life, that had to realize its possibilities in the closed givenness of an established space. But this distinction became quite clear to me when I reflected upon the particular items from American literature that the students asked me to read aloud. Primarily, of course, from the work of Melville, the periods of his prose rising and falling like the very ocean swell beneath which swam his gigantic creation, Moby Dick. Second, Walt Whitman, the intoxicating, line-loosening spaciousness of his rushing verse was enormously appealing to European students. And the third item, and in the 1930s, very excitedly, because these students then were reading Thomas Wolfe, they handed me those paragraphs in Thomas Wolfe's volume, Look Homeward, Angel, in which he describes the trip he took from Asheville to the city of Baltimore in a night train. And in a great passage, he tells how he stood on the platform between the cars under the enormous sky at night, talked of the great train plunging through the scattered villages whose few lights rushed past the cars as they roared quickly on into the darkness. And in the very headlong prose of Thomas Wolfe, I came to a realization of the difference between the yearning of life for satisfying order, as this is sought within the given space of the European peoples, and as that order is sought in America in the frightening boundlessness of our given space. Now, the second aspect of the theme to which I ask your attention is the frontier mind and technology. The role of technology in modern American life is, I think, more deeply understood if one sees it not simply as the extension of scientific knowledge, but among us as a way of life joyfully cultivated by a people who have retained a frontier mentality after the physical frontier has actually vanished. There is something strange in the joy and eagerness with which the technization of existence is celebrated in America, and every European knows it and wonders about it. This strangeness, I think, can be understood when one comes to see that the spirit that conquered a huge land is a spirit continuous with that which today plays with technology, just as a previous generation in America made a game out of felling trees, shocking corn, or plowing fields. The common man in America does not really understand the basic inquiries of a scientific sort which have given birth to technology, or the philosophical ideas which have attended its development. These are actually of very little concern to him. But technology for the common man in America is rather a stronger and a longer arm to conquer a wilderness with. His judgment that it is good is a purely pragmatic judgment. It gets the work done. His delight in it is very much akin to sheer uncritical boyishness. For in technology and its possibility to enhance and expand the forms of life, this common man sees a new wilderness to conquer. In fact, he uses that language about it. Or new frontiers to pierce, and he uses that language about technology. Now that this simple and uncritical acclaim should surround the advance of technology in America is evidence of the spirit that has never had to come to terms, really, with boundary, limit, the end. When one county was settled in our history and the best land taken up, the records indicate that new waves of people pushed up from the east went straight through and on to the unsettled next county. And then, when the trees were felled, the land cleared, the men found an abundance of rich earth for their taking. That land was cut up into organized states, and most of it became settled. Finally, the farthest ocean had been reached. But the promise of technology is seen in the American mind as simply a new frontier that evokes from this people a response whose inward character is identical with the response of their fathers. We talk about a new telephone system or a new TV gadget or something, as we talked about new counties on the illimitable frontier. They were simply new frontiers that stood always out in front of us. So much for the matter of space as a powerful influence upon the development of the American mind, spirit, and character. And now I should like to turn to a relation of how space and time are related in our American experience. In 1954, Professor Sidney Mead, then of the University of Chicago, published a brilliant essay in which he discussed this matter, and his first paragraph announced what he intended to do. That paragraph reads as follows: "I should like to suggest that in the shaping of the American mind and spirit, space has thus far overshadowed time in formative significance, and to suggest some of the implications of this insight. Mr. Mead begins the next paragraph with the recollection of Hector St. John Crevecoeur, who in 1782 asked a question in his Essays to an American Farmer, asked a question that has not ceased to trouble all thoughtful men in this place ever since. De Crevecoeur asked himself and his correspondents, what then is this American, this new man? I think that's an important question for two reasons. First of all, because it shows that this French visitor to our country saw that there was something new about the American man that had been created by his American experience. And second, because he saw that what was new was not to be separated from the experience of space as this penetrated the immigrants from the closed and tight spaces of the old world. The formative power of this vast and seeming illimitable land that had been available to the American man during the formative years of his nation's life can only be rightly felt when this existence in space is seen over against that existence in time, which is the way people experience life when space is not illimitably available to them. I mentioned at the beginning that these people had been without exception, people who came from closed spaces. And that means that within boundaries that are given by political or social or economic causes, within given spaces, one generation followed another within the confines of a familiar place. They were born, they lived, they died, often within the confines of the same shire or county or little princely kingdom. They were forced to find what freedom and fulfillment they could for the human mind and spirit, not within the context of space, because illimitable and fresh space was not available to them, but rather within the context of time. Time as duration, as the endless flow and flux of events within given space. Now, Mr. Mead in his essay suggests that in the New World, here in America, the power of the twin forces of space and time was actually reversed. Here it was space that constituted the field of operations of a man's life, space that became the matrix of personal and familial and vocational decisions, and this spaciousness has actually entered into our very vocabulary. We talk, for instance, of a new birth of freedom that an American president was to celebrate, and observe upon analysis that by freedom, we in America do not mean fundamentally a concept, but rather a geographical thing, unconfined movement in space. Another illustration of the relationship of space and time in the formation of a people's spirit can come from verse. I choose from Stephen Vincent Benet's Western Star a couple of lines. In his long poem, which has to do with the period of the wagon trains as they followed up the valley of the Missouri on their way to the Sierra, from his long poem Western Star, I want to pick a particular episode. In his poem, the poet talks of the relentless struggle of these little communities as broken loose from their old communities on the eastern seaboard or in the Middle West. They made their way over the hazards of the old Oregon Trail. And he tells, too, of the pathos of that journey, of death as it struck particularly the very old and the very young. And he puts into language something of the pathos of the men who, forbidden time for reflection, had to hurtle on into new space. One instance is this. On a certain day, the poet tells us, the wagon train had to halt in the fierce winter of the high plains in the west, there to dig a pathetic small grave for a child who had died. And I call your attention to the two lines. There is no time to grieve now. There is no time. There is only time for labor in the cold. Mr. Mead also calls our attention to the work of another man from New England, Francis Parkman, who, in order to study the Indians, undertook the terrifying privations of the Oregon Trail. And he calls our attention to an entry in Parkman's journal on a day when, hunting for food, he shot an antelope. It was against Parkman's principles on this journey to shoot animals for food, but the food he had taken along had become exhausted. He had no alternative. And the day after he did that, he entered in his journal the following sentence. When I stood by his side, the antelope turned his expiring eye upward. It was like a beautiful woman's, dark and bright. Fortunate that I am in a hurry, thought I. I might be troubled by remorse if I had time for it. Now the point of those two, Stephen Benet's verse and Francis Parkman's journal entry, is that the American man has always been short of time. And not only time in the sense of hours to do things in, but time rather as the awareness of passingness. Time as the remembered and somber music of man's enormous journey in this life. Time in the sense of that absolute mutability in which all life is lived, so that nothing lasts, that all things pass, that all days lean forward into the next. Time as a knowledge of life unfolding, always moving toward death. Professor Perry Miller of Harvard University, in his remarkable books about the formation and the disintegration of New England Puritanism, points out that the failure to remember man's mutability was replaced within three generations by a religious attitude that believed, under the precious oversight of God, this favored American man could do anything he wanted. And thus it has come about that the American man was short on a knowledge of the mordant awareness of time and limitation, largely because he has been so long on space. And whoever would understand America's past in order to deepen his wisdom as he envisions her future must measure the consequences of this, that space has overshadowed time in the formation of all of the ideas most cherished by the American mind and spirit. It is useful to observe, as many have, that the general concept of freedom in America has become spatialized. We find it difficult to think of the actual exercise of freedom in terms other than terms of unhampered movement in space. Professor Mead, in the same essay to which I alluded a moment ago, makes a nice illustration of this when he points to the fact that the trailer house hitched to an automobile is as fitting a symbol of the modern American's concept of freedom today as once were the saddlebags, the rifle, and the axe. And he goes on to point out that the Civil War can be seen as an attempt to exercise the freedom of flight from an undesirable alliance, and that war had almost as much appeal in the North as in the South, because it seemed to offer a way to solve the problems of our republic by fleeing from them into available space. But he also calls our attention to this, that one of the evidences of the genius of the gaunt, brooding man in the White House during the Civil War was in this, that he saw that in the long run, this idea of freedom as movement in space is an inadequate conception of freedom. And the fact that he reminded his fellow Americans that, quote, the mystic cords of memory that bound the union of these people together could not be stifled by the simple expedient of dividing themselves along a geographical line. Of the authenticity of the insight represented in the notion of the fact that space has overshadowed time in the formation of the American mind and spirit, I think there can be little doubt. But the final task of this lecture has got to be to ask after the sufficiency of such a way of feeling, thinking, planning for the future of our society. The terms of the issue are, I believe, quite clear, and they might be stated in this way. Can a mentality and a spirit nurtured upon the availability of open space, can such a mentality even envision, much less successfully attack the tasks that now confront us? Can the indubitable spiritual energies called forth and shaped by the frontier be informed, disciplined, reformed, and released for an American future whose setting is a radically different one? Or put it a third way, operations in open space make appropriate and effective a manner of public order that is pragmatic. But can operations in a closely woven, technologically organized, ecologically integrated and delicate structure, can these be rightly guided by the same cast of mind? Put it another way, is the institutionalization of pragmatism an adequate public philosophy for circumstances which in 1,000 large and small particulars are quite new? Can the spirit that won a continent sustain a national community? The answer, in my judgment, is clearly no. And let's sum the matter up with the following question. Man lives in space and in time. These dimensions of his actual existence are profound symbols, and reflection upon them might offer some help as we move together into the days that lie ahead. Because space offers options that may be realized by moving, time stands as a symbol for historical accomplishments of order and human good that have got to be made where one is and cannot move. Space may operate to confront issues by flight. Time is the symbol of a givenness and a boundedness within which the less dramatic but tougher and ultimately more human society has got to be attempted by discipline of the mind and the spirit. Time stands for the symbol that human values can be achieved by standing where one is rather than running away. Time in history stands for maturity, order, discipline, choice. The spirit of the man who looks out upon the future simply as space, and the spirit of the man who looks inward upon the issues of order and fulfillment for human life in time. This difference is too profound for an abstraction, and therefore I want to make a comparison. You recall a moment ago I spoke of the line-loosened and spacious rhetoric of Walt Whitman, who celebrated American space. I want now to read five little stanzas from another European-American, George Santayana, who speaks as the time man. He calls his little poem Cape Cod. The long sandy beach and the thin scrub pine, the wide reach of a bog, the long skyline, oh, I am far from home. The salt, salt smell of the thick sea air and the smooth round stones that the ebb tides wear? When will the good ship come? The wretched stumps all charred and burned, and the soft deep rut where the cartwheel turned, why is the world so old? The lapping wave and the broad gray sky where the cawing crows and the slow gulls fly, where are the dead untold? And among the dark pines and along the dark shore, oh, the wind and the wind forevermore, what will become of man? That kind of question, you see, is really not asked when men have illimitable space in which to exhaust their energies and expand their visions. But that kind of question is precisely the kind of question that now bugs our American life. And it seems to me that we can no longer ignore it. We have fashioned a society and an industrial order at a cost, and the bill is due and payable. The magnificence of our spatial endowment has been cleverly used and appallingly abused. The accumulated garbage of that achievement has befouled the air, polluted the water, scarred the land, besmirched the beautiful, clogged and confused our living space. We have so managed all human placement and means of movement as to convenience us as consumers and insult us as persons. Now it seems to me that there are evidences in American life that we are beginning to understand that thoughts formed in space may not be adequate for circumstances confronted in historical time, and that our national mind is leading into a more realistic encounter with our human issues. The reality of limit and boundary, the educating forces for the human spirit that operate when one cannot move on or start afresh, but must come to terms with life where it is and deal with the situations as we find them. This kind of force, it seems to me, has been gathering ever since, for instance, the Korean War, when for the first time with a shock we began to understand that there are some situations that cannot be solved by force, by overwhelming energy, by sheer resolution. We are perhaps finding out also in our involvement in Vietnam that there are spatial problems which sheer flexing of muscles cannot solve, and in our racial problem, we are, it seems to me, gaining a more mature American mind. We have learned between Birmingham and Memphis and the decline of the social order and the provision for human good in our great cities that men must mature mind and spirit by temporal reflection upon history and what is available for humanity, rather than simply moving to some suburb or other, whether this be an intellectual movement or an actual physical one. One of the most troubling aspects of our contemporary moment in American life is simply this, that we tend to look upon our difficulties as due to a breakdown in law and order. But far below whatever breakdown that phrase may point to is another breakdown, that man's mind and spirit operates and is educated by two magnitudes, space and time. And inasmuch as we have been primarily determined by spatial availability, we have perhaps inadequately developed those aspects of reflection and resolution which come when we acknowledge that we live boundedly within time.
Our speaker today was Joseph Sittler, professor in the Divinity School of the University of Chicago, talking on time, space, and the American experience.